Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
He's not human. He is like a machine. Making more podcasts than you've ever seen. He was never programmed for a life. Because the show is the extent of his social life. It's the Taryn Show. Don't ask if he's single, you already know. Cause it's the Taryn Show. A simple name for a simple guy with a simple face. It's the Taryn Show.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Taryn Show. I am very excited about this episode. For all the Big Brother fans, all the old school Big Brother fans, you definitely know who this guy is that I'm going to be talking to this week. I was very excited to get him so that we could talk to him. It's all the way from Big Brother 2. It's Hardy. How you doing, Hardy?
Taryn, so good to talk to you. So good to hear your voice. And thank you so much for your thoughtful consideration and having me as your guest this week.
Yes, thank you. Rob Sesternino and I recorded a like 20-hour audiobook going back and rewatching season 2 last year.
Was that accompanied by a commentary?
Yes, yeah. We basically walked through every episode.
I can only imagine the commentary.
Yeah, it was having a lot of fun with it. It was quite a while ago.
Yeah, well, there was a lot of fun to be had with that, I imagine.
Yes, but I'm very excited to have you on. I'm sure there are a lot of people that would be very interested in hearing from you. What is life? How has life been since Big Brother?
Life has been interesting. I was in Miami when I was casting the show, and a few times they had me in Miami Beach, and then they referred to me from New York, Pennsylvania, which is my hometown. So I lived in Miami Beach for 18 years. I just recently moved to Chicago, but when I was in Miami, I had become the general manager of Skybar at the Shore Club Hotel. Opened that and ran that for 3 years and just really dubbed into my profession in hospitality and really kind of excelled at that. And then I rejoined the Opium Group as their ambassador at large. And I oversaw the operations for VIP and guest accommodations for 8 nightclubs in Miami, New York, and Las Vegas. So that was quite a whirlwind period. And then I kind of slowed down a little bit. I began working for a company called the Faena Hotel. I was the director of their VIP lounge called the Living Room, and which is actually where my beautiful wife, Liz. And Liz and I now have a beautiful 9-month-old little girl named Sage. We moved to Chicago, and I'm still working in the hospitality industry at the moment.
Awesome. Was that always your plan growing up to get into the hospitality industry, or is that something that kind of sprung on you?
Well, no, it's interesting. I've always had this kind of innate sense of accommodating people and making them feel welcome and making sure that there's around me wherever I'm at, that they're in a good place and they're having fun and they're enjoying themselves, especially in the social atmosphere. And it's just something that kind of like, I guess people saw it in me. And it just always came natural to me. But when I started conversing with different people in the industry and the profession, like Ian Schrager from Orient Hotel Group, and one of the innovators of Studio 54, and as well as a ton of other people, it just kind of came out of me that this is kind of like what I'm really, really good at because it comes so naturally. And I think that, anyone that's good at something that comes naturally to them and they can make a living at it, they should definitely pursue it, because if you're doing something you love, as the old cliche goes, if you're doing something you love, it doesn't feel like work. So that came to me through, consultations with other people, and it just kind of made sense for me. It was very natural.
Yeah, it makes sense. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in York, Pennsylvania. Actually, when I was much, much younger, I was born in York, and then my my family moved around the Washington, D.C. area, like Byrd, Virginia, Alexandria, Virginia, Falls Church, Virginia, and Bethesda, Maryland. And then moved back to Pennsylvania, and that's where, for the most part, I grew up. My mother, unfortunately, passed away when I was 11 years old, and I then was raised by my grandparents. Thankfully, my father was always involved with our lives as we were growing up. But my grandparents basically were the ones that, you know, we lived with them, and you know, they were our primary caretakers. And, you know, the fact that if you can learn from your elders and learn from your grandparents and the respect that, you know, that their generation had for things they've gone through so much, you know, they've seen so much in our country's history, and they kind of embed those qualities and those sensibilities in you, those morals, and innate sensibilities. I think it's, you know, it was a great thing for me. I kind of felt like I was raised old school.
Yeah.
As far, really, you know, very respectful, you know, very considerate and thoughtful as possible.
Yeah. I mean, what is it like to lose a parent so young?
It's extremely heart wrenching. You know, it does in many ways have far reaching consequences. You know, it affects your ability to develop a compelling and long term interest in someone, because as soon as you might feel that, you know, someone's pulling back, whether it be a romantic interest specifically, what have you, you tend to kind of want to shut that down because you don't have to experience the pain of what that loss might be for you again. It's almost like tearing open that wound, like pulling off a scab and pouring like salt on it. You know, so, you know, in those ways, it's very difficult. But the good thing is that, you know, once you kind of recognize, you know, the effects that those, you know, that might have, you know, obviously through counseling, what have you, you address that issue. You can come away from it with, you know, a broader understanding of yourself and relationships in general.
Yeah, definitely. Do you feel like having, I mean, you talked about how your grandparents had, you know, this greater wisdom that they were able to bring you. Do you feel like that gave you an advantage growing up?
I think it helped me stand apart in a way out of, you know, just being more thoughtful, more considerate, and more respectful. You know, the whole bullying thing that seems so predominant in today's society, and, you know, and especially in youth and in, you know, in kids that are in school. You know, that was something that, you know, that I was raised to kind of rally against. I was always, you know, not necessarily for the underdog, but for what was right, you know, and picking on kids and bullying kids, you know, that's something that, you know, I got in fist fights. I got suspended in middle school for getting into an encounter for some kids that were, you know, bullying a girl with cerebral palsy. So I, you know, for me to see what's happening today, I wish that there was more parents and grandparents that had more influence of respect and of consideration and thoughtfulness for their peers that I was able to garner from my upbringing.
Yeah, for sure. You know, you are a very fit guy. Were you like one of a bigger kind of fit kid in high school or growing up as well?
No. Actually, my brother was always like my idol. He was 22 months older than I was. He still is. That hasn't changed.
Yeah.
But when we were growing up, he was, you know, a champion diver. He was a really, a great swimmer. And we were both great swimmers. We were younger, but he was the competitor, and you know, he was a diver, and you know, it was, you know, it's kind of like when you're growing up at that age, you know, you look to your brother to be, you know, what you want to aspire to, or kind of, you know, you kind of like always look up to your brother if you have an older brother in some capacity, whether you have one or two or what have you. But for me, I was always kind of like skinny, and I always had this like chicken breastbone in my chest that I was always embarrassed of when I was like 12, 13, 14. And, it was a great concern. So I'd spoken to my father, and he said, you just need to start, like, you know, working out and using weights. So, you know, I'd always played soccer and I always swam when I was younger. And I was a really good baseball player as well. I took up tennis in high school, and so I just started, you know, working out. And, you know, my regimen, you know, was in high school. I was, you know, soccer, swimming, and tennis. And so just through that activity and through that competitive environment, you know, you just start developing. And I guess, you know, your body changes as you grow older. So I kind of came into it, but I always did really have an affiliation for, you know, for physical activity and for working out. I just liked the way it felt, you know, when I was done. Like, you know, nowadays, like, you know, when I work out, it's, you know, I still have that same sense of accomplishment of, you know, my day is like, right. I, you know, I started my day properly, like, you know, I'm dialed in, I'm ready to rock the day, you know, one of those things.
Yeah. What kind of workouts do you still do?
Pretty much almost the same workout that I've always done. You know, I like to start my day with jumping rope. I do interval training, so I'll do, like, you know, 15 minutes jumping rope forwards, and then some plyometrics push-ups. You know, some one-legged dips. One-legged, you know, leg dips, and you know, just mix it up with plyometrics and abdominal workout, and then, you know, reverse it again for 10 minutes. Reverse jump rope. Do another cycle of the same plyometrics, and then forward for another 30 minutes. And just, you know, it really gets the blood pumping. You know, it's not like the same weight training that I used to do. I just don't have the time to do that. But just to kind of make sure everything's, like, you know, smooth running and and feeling good and lubricated. Like, you know, I try not to creak when I walk. You know, I try to make sure that, you know, I get the blood flowing and have a really good sense of accomplishment when I'm done.
Cool. So, you know, what was the plan growing up? Like, you were in high school, like, did you have an idea of where you were going to go with your life at that point?
No. And I think that was the greatest excitement about it. You know, I'd wanted to be in sales and in business. My father was in business. So I kind of wanted to definitely, you know, generate a high volume of revenue, and just, you know, have, you know, you see what your grandparents and parents have, you know, when you're up and you want to have that, but, you know, I wanted much more than that. So I got into sales, I got into marketing. That's what I studied in college. And, so that was kind of where my head was at, where I thought I was going to hang my hat, when I was much younger.
Yeah. Well, so, when did Big Brother come along? Like, you were pretty young still, right?
Yeah, I don't know about young, but at the time I was, I'd moved from Pennsylvania to Miami to open an advertising agency for a company that I'd worked for in Pennsylvania called Do It Outdoors, which is an out-of-home media company. And they basically contracted me to do 4 months in three different cities to open an office, hire a sales manager, hire a sales team, train everyone, introduce them to the different client base in that market, and then move to the next market. So my markets were going to be Chicago, Boston, and Miami. And, you know, I had the ability to choose where I was going to start first. So I happened to choose Miami, and lo and behold, and everything kind of ran from there. That was kind of like the main impetus for me to move to Miami from Pennsylvania. And, you know, in living in Miami, not knowing anyone, you know, I just happened to at lunch run into my waiter actually invited me to stop by his gym that he was a member of. He was listening because, you know, you're new to town. Like, yeah. And I explained into my story. You know, I'm just here to, you know, open an office and I'm looking for office space right now and blah, blah, blah. So we exchanged information and he actually became, you know, one of my great friends, a great friend, Steven Traeger. So he got me into the South Florida boxing gym and I started studying Thai kickboxing. And that led me to meeting a gentleman named Jax Fontaine, who was kind of my mentor in Thai kickboxing and my trainer. And he happened to be the head of security for a company called the Oakland Group. And after a certain amount of time, you know, a tinier level of acumen with regards to Thai kickboxing. Listen, you know, I basically run security for this company. If you're interested in, you know, doing some nights with us, I'd love to have you. You know, I'm comfortable with having you as a representative of me. So I think that that's a little bit of a sign of respect. And I was like, sure, I don't know anyone in Miami. Otherwise, I'd be spending my time, you know, indoors, you know, on Fridays and Saturday nights because I didn't know anybody. And so I did that. And I got to meet a lot of great people. And through that, I got into the Open Group and that's kind of started my nightlife hospitality hotel, restaurant, nightclub opening spree.
There you go. That makes sense. What exactly were you doing in that job? Like, what kind of tasks did you have?
For what? For security?
Yeah. I've always been curious. Like, when you work security, like, what do you just like stand there looking intimidating?
So that was the differentiation. So that was what everyone else did. Okay. So when I was in college, I'd spent my summers as a surf rescue technician or a surf rescue lifeguard in Ocean City, Maryland. And I'd done that for like 3 or 4 years. And when you're a surf rescue lifeguard, if you're good, you always scan your head, just not stopping. You're left to right, scanning the water, scanning the air behind you, left to right. You're always looking, you're always watching. And I kind of use the same approach to you know, I would be at my post and I would just scan the environment, scan the room. And if I would see something that would pop up or I, you know, notice someone's, you know, facial expression didn't seem, you know, normal for the environment, or they were like, you know, you can tell if something's going down, you can read somebody's face if they're getting upset, or if you're intuitive and you can just kind of feel something's not right. That's what I was kind of dialed into. And so what I would do is I would go and approach the situation, but I would be able to de-escalate the situation and kind of control the situation and reduce it. Whereas everyone else would just kind of only address it when there was a problem and there were fists flying. I was able to go to the issue and speak to individuals, resolve the problem. The guests would stay in play. The money would continue to flow to the company and everyone would be happy, as opposed to, you know, risking a lawsuit, throwing people out, losing potential revenue, opportunity costs, the whole thing. And I think that's what they kind of saw me as, you know, being really, really good at is, you know, seeing potential issues, de-escalating the problem, and making sure that, you know, we're preserving our revenue opportunity.
Makes sense. Did you ever have any like crazy incidents where something did happen?
Yeah, unfortunately I did. And I hadn't even worked with Jax at the time. He was running head security. I was in the restaurant called, at that point it was Opium. And it was like a sushi bar that would turn into like kind of like a nightclub lounge. And there was this gentleman that was just like, it was with a girl, a very, very beautiful woman, actually. The gentleman was obviously of Hispanic descent, which is absolutely normal for South Florida. So nothing seemed out of the ordinary, except that he seemed to become aggravated for some reason. And he actually started, he had roses on his table. He started throwing roses like other tables, like erratically. And so I approached him. And, you know, I was trying to calm the situation down, and he grabbed me. He grabbed me by the front of my collar of my shirt, and he grabbed me. Big mistake. He grabbed me, and my initial instinct was to put my hand. He had his thumb sticking out. I grabbed his thumb and just started pulling it backwards towards him until it snapped because he wouldn't let go of me. And as soon as it snapped, his eyes popped open and like his eyes like popped. And by that point, whoever he was with, I didn't know who he was, but he had people with him. And our security came upstairs as well. And when his eyes popped open, he was on something, because there's no way that the pressure of me pulling back on your thumb to the point where it's about to break, that would normally stop anyone, just the pain of that. But when it actually popped and popped out of its socket, his eyes like really popped open, and that's when, you know, things got exciting. But we handled the situation. It wasn't a good situation for the gentleman. There was actually an article or a news event that happened with regards to that. I can't remember exactly what the details were that were reported, but the gentleman made a big mistake and was very aggressive. And you just don't grab people by the scruff of their collar and the front and think that that's going to be okay. And you know, yeah. not stop, you know, when you're directed to, like if you're in a restaurant, for God's sake.
So how long had you been working security before? Because were you working security when you went on Big Brother?
Yeah, so I was still doing the hiring and developing of the ad agency during the day at night. Only on the weekends I was doing security, and also I was doing some modeling there as well. And my agent had contacted me. And had mentioned, you know, your question was, how did I get to come to Big Brother?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I'd done some modeling, and my agent had called me and had mentioned that there was an audition for Big Brother. Now, the first season of Big Brother, I saw, and I thought I was, like, watching paint dry. I thought it was very boring.
Yeah.
It was, you know, the layout of the presentation was kind of weird. It was 30 minutes for 6 days a week. Not a lot of time to develop any storylines or what have you, or edit things, so... My initial reaction was, I'm not really interested. I've watched that show. It's not like something I'd be interested in looking into. But my agent had apparently done her homework, and she said, no, it's a different production company. It's Our House Productions, and they're changing the whole layout of everything. They're changing the dynamic of everything. They're changing the structure. They're changing the presentation. I was like, well, all right, well, whatever. So it just basically got me to go to the audition. I did the audition. It was doing, like, you know, introducing yourself and, you know, asking some questions or answering some questions that were asked off camera. And then they guess they submitted it, and I got a phone call. I had a casting director come to Miami Beach, and I met with them, and interviewed with them. And then I got invited to go to Los Angeles. So I went to Los Angeles for like 4 or 5 days, stayed at one of the hotels there. You could tell there's a bunch of other possible candidates. We weren't allowed to talk to anybody. Basically anybody, unless they were associated with production. Mm-hmm. So we wouldn't be in cahoots with anyone or get to really exchange information or meet anybody. So that happened. And then at the end of that, there was like an interview process. They did a personality test. They did blood test. They did a full physical. And then I guess they kind of narrowed it down. And then a certain amount of us were introduced to, we went to a meeting with Les Mundes, who is the president of CBS. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of like the final meeting. And then we went back to the hotel, and then I was in my room, and the casting director knocked on my door and came in and said, listen, you know, we're considering you seriously. If you're given this opportunity, would you be able to, within 3 or 4 hours, be able to jump on a plane once you're notified, or, you know, once you're aware? And I was like, I guess so. Like, you know, think about it, like, we're given the opportunity, sure, why not? So I flew out the next day, flew back to Miami. And then I got a phone call that they were going to send a camera crew to interview with me or to, you know, showcase what I was doing for the morning. And I just happened to be scheduled to do a workout at South Florida Boxing with my trainer. So they had the film crew come in, and I was doing my workout, and they were filming me, and everyone kind of thought it was weird, and I thought it was weird, but they kind of positioned it as, oh, you're one of the finalists. It was kind of like showing, you know, but, you know, what made, you know, if you are picked, you know, this is what we'll show. I was like, whatever. And so lo and behold, I guess the producer of the segment, you know, told me to go into my gym bag. I went in my gym bag, and there was a key there. And I go, I turn around and go, are you fucking shitting me? Are you fucking shitting me right now? And I was laughing. I was like, so, like, in disbelief. And that wasn't necessarily the verbal reaction they were looking for.
Yeah.
So they're like, can you just go back and not swear? I was like, well, sure. Yeah, I'll do that for you.
They go through all the trouble of making sure it's a surprise, but then they can't use the footage of the genuine surprise.
That's television for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what was going through your mind this whole time? Like, were you excited to go on TV? Like, what was the goal?
Well, there really was no goal. I mean, the after coming back from the 3 or 4 day trip to LA, it was, you know, there was a lot of people there. I'm not sure how many people, but there was definitely more than 12. There was probably, it felt like there was like maybe 60 or 70, if not more. Mm-hmm. You had to take a personality test and all this stuff. It was almost like you were applying for, you know, like a college or something.
Yeah.
It was very, very weird. It was a little crazy to comprehend. There wasn't really no intent for me to kind of be on TV. That was the I guess to me, it's like that was the best part about it. Like, it just was like, it just kind of like all flowed seamlessly and almost effortlessly. I didn't really try too hard. I didn't really overly apply myself or feel like I was like, you know, trying to get at something that was unachievable. It just kind of happened. You know, I didn't want to do the application. My agent came to do the application. I did that. And then everything else kind of like fell into place. It was, there was really no kind of like an overt want or need for me to participate in this. It really kind of fell into my lap. And from there, everything just kind of worked, you know. I really don't know any other way to say it. There was never no like mental specific intent. I need to, I want to be in this show. It's like, oh, if it happens, it happens. If not, oh, great, whatever. I'm doing this on Tuesday. life was just going to continue. But yeah, it's funny because I remember that the producer for the segment, actually, when they gave me the key, they're like, you have like 3 hours to be on this plane. Like, you need to handle your business. So I literally had to write checks for every month for all my utilities and for everything, and for, you know, for the next 3 or 4 months, and drop them off at a friend's place after I packed my bag. We were on our way to the airport. I just casually just threw like shorts and whatever summer clothes I could find, which is why you don't see me having a whole variety of you know, of attire when I was on the show. And we got on the plane, and on the way to the airport, the producer was like, "Are you ready for this?" And I'm like, I had no idea what you're talking about. And he's like, "No, man." He's like, "You don't have any idea, do you?" I'm like, "Not really." I'm like, "This is really kind of new. Like, it just happened 2 hours ago."
Yeah.
He's like, "This is going to change your life." And I'm like, I just didn't feel that or understand or see it. But he was in a few ways, and more than a few ways, he was right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, you get to LA, like, was there ever a point where you where it felt like it hit you? Like, okay, I'm doing this. I'm going to be locked in this place for, you know, however many days. And, you know, it's like, was there ever a moment where that just all kind of hit you?
I guess it was right before we came out. So when I got back to LA, I went to a hotel room, and I think the show started like a day or two after that. And so I was in a hotel, and I wasn't allowed to call anybody, but my chaperone at the time had left the hotel room to go do something, but he left his phone there. And so I grabbed his phone, and I let my dad know and my brother know that I was going to be in the show and kind of give them an update as to what was happening. But yeah, like, other than that, I guess the reality hit me. We were in these trailers, you know, we'd come on, we were, you know, hustled on set. We had relatively two bags with us. We were brought on set, and they were putting these little, like, super, super small trailers, like literally, it almost felt like a cattle stall, but it was supposed to be like a trailer, you know, what have you. But it was one of those, like, kind of like four different sections, with, you know, very, very small rooms. And the security guy came to my door and asked me for my bags, and they had to go check through everyone's bags to make sure no one had any illicit, you know, contraband or drugs or what have you, and that everything was approved that you were bringing into the house. And I think that was when it hit me, like when we were then brought out and we all kind of like came to the front of the house and we all kind of like looked at each other for the first time. That's when it really like hit me. There was cameras there, and it's just like, okay, it's like almost like a deer in the headlights feeling, but you realize like you kind of have to go through the, you know, just kind of go with your instincts and go through the motions, because you don't want to like look foolish or what have you. So just like, holy shit, this is really happening. Let's just keep going with the flow. Let's see how this pans out.
So, when did you learn about the new rules and how the game was going to work? and stuff?
Actually, when I kind of offered a retort to my modeling agent, I saw the show, and because she was referencing, Big Brother, and my thought pattern was, I referenced the first season, which I saw, and it wasn't that interesting. And I said that to her, and she said, well, they're changing everything. There's a new production company working with Endemol. It's called Our House Productions and Arnold Shapiro. And so I was like, okay, because I knew Arnold Shapiro was Scared Straight and what have you. Mm-hmm. So I was like, all right. What's there to lose? It's not like at that moment I was committing to being on the show. Is that that moment I'm committing to 5 minutes on a videotape, mm-hmm. So it wasn't something that I had to think a whole lot about. Just like, it just didn't, my first point of reference wasn't something that I'd be interested in, but the fact that, they argued back and took the time to explain what was happening with the production is what made the difference. Cause if they wouldn't have said anything back to me, I wouldn't have done it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have done an interview.
did you like, was there a point that you started to formulate a strategy based on the new rules or anything, or did it just seem, did you approach it the same way that you might've approached the first season?
Well, I didn't really watch the first season. Again, I watched it maybe two or three episodes and that's it. And I was just like, it was boring to me. So I think the difference between the first and the second was that America voted people out. Like, the head of household nominated two people, and then America through phone tallies would call in mm-hmm. people. I didn't really have to play to that audience. You have to play to the audience that you're with. Now, the downside of it is that, you obviously have to nominate two people, one of which is going to be around, to stick around. So my thought process was, if that's the situation, make the second person someone, pick one person that you really want to get out. The second person is, you'll kind of be able to, depending upon your influence on other people, you'll be able to kind of control what the vote might be towards them and towards your goal of getting somebody out. But you always want to kind of have that second person as someone that you could, you could resolve things with. You could come back to and be like, hey, it's just a game, and hang out with and make amends with and kind of mend that division.
Yeah. And, we saw Mike Boogie in the very first, HOH attempt a similar strategy and have it, blow back in his face.
Yeah, that certainly set the tone. I'll definitely say that set the tone for the entire summer that year, for the entire season. That just, it was a them against us. And for, and again, Mike, Mike and I are friends, and Will and I are friends. And, we miss each other. We see each other very, very infrequently. Whenever I'm in Los Angeles, I always like try to look those guys up. But they're really great guys. And, we've grown, I think, fonder and with more respect of each other outside of the house, because in the house, it's almost like Lord of the Flies, if you think about it. And, you have the people in the one area, and all of a sudden, that's called the hot box or the other people or whatever.
Yeah.
Then you've got the other area where it's just cooler temperature wise, it's colder, and they call that area Chill Town.
Yep.
And those people kind of gravitate. It's literally like, it's sociology 101. People will obviously find common ground with those that they're in close proximity to. And mm-hmm. if there is a divisive area, like the living room of the house during that season, and you have the other side of the house, those people will talk and gravitate and stay just by natural happenstance. It's just human nature.
Yeah, and I think
that play out.
Yeah, I think there's also part of it too, where you talked about growing up with your grandparents and how you were kind of raised a little more like old fashioned, where a lot of the younger people were hanging out with Chill Town, but you were aligning more with some of the older people.
Well, I don't think it had to do anything specifically with reference to age. Mm-hmm. I think it just had more specific reference to people's personalities, what I perceive them as. Like, there were some cool people in the show. Shannon, at one point, during I guess we did a fast or something that at Will's suggestion,
yeah.
and I think Autumn, I don't know, completed or something. And so Shannon threw a bag of chips on her bed and, you know, just like lame shit like that. And what she did with my, what she did with my toothbrush, for God's sake, just like stuff like that, you know, it's like, it kind of speaks for itself.
Yeah, like when that happens, when you find out that she's cleaned the toilet with your toothbrush, like, is there a moment where you're just like, what am I doing on this? What have I done with myself?
Well, no, it wasn't like what I'd done with myself. It's more like what's wrong with that person.
Yeah.
You know, like it wasn't the environment because nobody else was doing that stuff. It was like, what the hell is wrong with her? Like, what's wrong with her mind? And I mean, I guess at some point she fessed up to it, but you know, she denied it. And that's always been like a thing, that whole toothbrush incident. But I was obviously thoroughly upset, you know, that someone would take it to that level where, you know, I could possibly be fucking like infected with serious diseases, and infections that would be like a joke and acceptable at our age. You know, we're not in fourth grade or third grade or whatever she referenced in the broadcast. But yeah, that was obviously extremely disappointing on a multitude of levels. On a multitude of levels. Like, on a humanity's level. Really?
Did you ever sort of reconcile with Shannon? Like, are you on good terms with her at all now?
I haven't spoken to her in a while, and you know, I guess we resolved everything. We talked when after 9/11 happened. There was no commercial air flights, so they, like, CBS hired a private jet to pick us all up so we could go to do the finale show. And on that flight, they picked me up in Miami and we flew to Texas and dropped in and picked her up in Texas, on our way to LA. You know, we had a glass or two of wine on the plane and, you know, whatever, bygones be bygones. I'm not somebody that holds grudges. You know, it's not like I used the toothbrush, you know, like that'd be a different story. I'd obviously be a lot more pissed, but the intent and the actuality of the situation didn't come to fruition, which is a good thing because obviously if it had, I probably wouldn't be at all forgiving. But it is what it is. You know, people do things under pressure and under circumstances that they don't normally live under. So I get that. And you know, we worked it out and it wasn't a big deal. Whatever. It's like water under the bridge.
Yeah. I mean, you talked about 9/11 that happened. It must have not been too long after you were evicted, right?
It happened Tuesday morning, after I was evicted on Thursday and I flew back to Pennsylvania, with my family. And that happened that Tuesday morning. I was actually staying at my friend, Matt Scarborough's house. We had gone on, just, you know, I was spending time with him and his family and it's like, you know, just stay here tonight. You don't have to like worry about driving or going anywhere. And I hadn't seen a lot of my good friends for a long time. And so I got up in the morning and a friend of mine called me and said, turn the TV on. And I turned the TV on and the first tower had already been hit. And then, you know, I was watching many people were, the live broadcast that was happening, and the second plane hit and my heart dropped. And at that point, everyone knew that something wasn't right. You know, and then as moments passed and seconds passed, you're just like, you're just the impact of everything that's happening, what you're watching unfold, the loss of life happening in real time as you're watching this, the intent behind that loss of life, because it was no way, shape, or form an accident at this point. It was almost overwhelming to kind of process. And I think it was like that for a lot of people. And as, you know, moments passed and the reality of the situation hit, you know, and played out. I mean, that should have been, got hit, and there was a couple hours or, you know, however long, 90 minutes or 2 hours since before they were hit till they fell. I mean, it was just horrific, you know, for the entire country, for everyone, for the world. So, yeah, that that kind of took over every thought from that point on.
Yeah, I know there was a lot of sort of like debate about, you know, first of all, like the you know, Will and Nicole and Monica, who were still in the house, had to be informed, and it took a couple of days to for them to, like, I guess, decide to do that. Yeah. And then there was debate about, you know, then like, should the show even continue? Because it seems so trivial, given everything that was happening around it.
Yeah. No, it was, I mean, it must have been a difficult decision for the team to process. Me personally, you know, my thought was always, don't, when that, something like that happens, I understand we're in an enclosed environment, but Monica's cousin was in, one of the trade towers. Mm-hmm. And you know, for this level of something to happen, this is something that's historic, impactful, specifically to someone that's taking part in the show. I think that, you know, given hindsight, that the producers probably would have acted a lot sooner, and that they might have acted a little bit differently. But again, that's the blessing of hindsight. You know, you can always get to kind of rethink things. But I think in the moment they did what they thought was just, fair, and best. And again, in hindsight, I definitely imagine they would have wanted to react a lot more quickly to end the show. Again, that's a tough call. There's tens of millions of dollars in production costs in these shows. You know, you see a $500,000 prize to the award winner, but that's literally a drop in the bucket compared to what it costs to actually put the show on. You know, to have the sets and the house built and all the production in and out, what have you, and the monitoring. There's just, you know, just a lot involved. So to have it go that far and not be produced, I know it must have been a very difficult decision for the producers to make. I think that, you know, given the timing and how much left of the show there wasn't a lot left. It really, I don't think, made a difference. I'm just thinking, I don't know if it would have made it that big of a difference if they would have canceled the show or just kept it going. But yeah, when, if you cancel the show, how you end it then? Do you like split it three ways? You know, it was a tough call for CBS and Our House Productions. You know, and nothing like that's ever happened. It probably was never conceived of, and you know, they made a decision under circumstances they never imagined.
Yeah. So
that, you know, those things can't be taken lightly, and there's a lot of things that impact this decision. So I guess I can't fault them for taking the amount of time that they did, but I guarantee you in hindsight, they probably would have probably preferred to have acted a lot quicker.
Yeah, for sure. What are your thoughts on sort of the season as a whole and Will and how he played the game now that you've had, you know, plenty of time to think back on it? Like how do you feel about it now?
Well, I think it was a blast, honestly. I think Will is definitely the best player in Big Brother history from what I've seen. I think a lot of characters and people attempt at interpretations of how he approach the game. He changed the dynamic of the show. He changed the dynamic of how the game is played, Big Brother, ultimately, in my mind, and irreversibly. So now it's more finessed. You know, there's, you know, I haven't really been keeping up with this season, but I can tell you from what I've seen of previous seasons and, you know, those that immediately followed our season, is that almost everyone kind of is, it's almost like everyone fits the mold, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's what you play with those cards or that mold that's going to decide how far along you get and ultimately if you win. It's interesting because everyone's, you know, has their perceptions, but when you're actually in it, you really kind of have to think quick on your feet, and it's definitely a long, it's almost like a long con, you know? Do you ever see like Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, the movie Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, like the long con, like it takes like, you know, weeks and weeks to play out. It's mm-hmm. almost like that. And that's what I think Will did. He's a genius of the long con in a good way, not in a bad way. I'm not down speaking him at all. Like, I love Will. I think he's awesome. He's a great dad. He's a great individual and a fun guy. And, I'm just saying like, you know, just the term, like the long play, like the long chess game, like thinking like many, many measures ahead of everyone else, and each measure three ahead for each individual person, how this would affect them. Like, you did this, how would this affect this person, that person, and that person, and what person, what would this person say to this person? It's like, really, you can almost drive yourself crazy. It's almost like a spider web.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, his relationship with you was one of the more interesting parts of the season, I think, where, you know, it was this back and forth where sometimes you'd seem like buddies, but then sometimes, you know, you'd see through him. And it was always this up and down relationship.
I mean, I'd always see through him, but I mean, it was when you're in those circumstances, you want to, like, you're in a very tight space for a long period of time. And what the audience gets to see is a very brief glimpse into that fishbowl. And the rest of the time we have to make it, you know, interesting for ourselves so we don't go crazy. And obviously you gravitate towards people. While you might not necessarily at the moment appreciate, you know, their approach, what they stand for, you can also find them amusing and entertaining and engaging. And helping pass the time and getting crazy and like jumping in the pool and like, you know, reenacting the scenes from the Titanic and like stupid shit like that. Like, you know, you'd be amazed at what you can come up with to pass the time. And I think in a multitude of those circumstances, Will was at the center of that. So while we had our philosophical differences, our entertainment value was high, and our appreciation to fulfill that need for each other. Yeah, we had some fun on the show.
Yeah.
When they didn't broadcast the stuff, we were like launching each other into the pool and doing like really dumb shit. But it was fun. It passed time.
For sure. So what was it like when everything ended and the season was over? How did your life change?
Well, I can tell you, as soon as I got the show, one of the production assistants, when I was in the green room, and I'd already spoken to my, you know, we were off camera. I went to the green room. I was waiting to do my exit interview. And this is after Julie, but waiting to do with the producers and what have you and CBS talent to get the check, my compensation. I was sitting backstage, and one of the production assistants, one of the, you know, younger guys on the, or younger people on the show, behind the scenes, goes, like, really, really, everyone's really excited, and really excited to meet me. I didn't understand that. Like, people in the house weren't that excited by me, but everyone outside was like super excited. It was really kind of like, it was really weird. But initially it was kind of like, it was interesting. And one of the production assistants goes, man, do you have any idea, like, the impact you'd have? And I'm like, I have no reference points of what he's referring to. I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, man, he's like, the LA area has like got a shortage of jump ropes because of you. I'm like, well, what are you talking about? I'm like, are you serious? He's like, yeah, man. He's like, no one can buy jump ropes because everyone watches you jump rope. I'm like, you're in such good shape, so everyone's buying jump ropes now and jumping rope. I'm like, okay, interesting. And I go to like a bunch of these, you know, I guess the next morning, I did like 30 some interviews, on TV, radio, what have you. One of the last interviews was an audio interview that I did with CNN. And at this point I was exhausted because I didn't sleep the entire night. I'd gone out to Universal, with my brother, and they had these security people with us for some reason. And so I ended up actually, you know, having just some drinks with people from the production staff and hanging out with them and talking all night. And I had to be like, I guess downstairs at like 4 a.m. or something crazy, like 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. So I showered and went downstairs. I'm like still really tired because I hadn't slept, you know, and the anxiety of like being, you know, one of the people up for eviction on the show and blah, blah, blah. So I didn't get a whole lot of sleep. And the last thing that I'd done was at CNN. I guess I've seen an audio, and I'm sitting in the back of a limo. I'm just, and this woman has this recorder, and she's like, you know, asking all these questions. She goes, so honestly, what does it feel like to be America's number one, like, sex symbol? And I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? Because again, first and foremost, obviously I never would ever think of myself as anything like that. But to have someone verbalize that was like almost made me, like, if I was drinking any liquids, I would have like spat it out of my mouth. I was like, what the fuck are you talking? It was like hilarious to me, like, that somebody would say that to me. So I kind of laughed it up. I'm like, I don't know what the hell you're talking about, to be honest with you. And she's like, oh, you don't know. I'm like, no, like, I haven't been anywhere yet. I haven't seen anything yet. Like, you know. So it was weird to get off the show. And I'll tell you, when I went to the airport, there were people, there was, I guess there was like a People magazine or Us magazine that had an article about Big Brother on it. I guess I was in one of the pictures. And so people were coming up to me at the airport and asking me to sign their magazine. So I'm like, this was bizarre, like absolutely bizarre, because it really does freak you out, because you go from, you know, seeing people for 2.5 months or how long I was there, and just seeing one of those people, to having people treat you 110%, not necessarily doing it, but like, you know, they want, like, they're like, you know, they're clamoring around you, they're wanting your autograph, they're wanting pictures and stuff. It's completely mind-blowing. And it's not necessarily a comforting feeling. It wasn't for me. It was like, it was very bizarre. And slowly off-putting. I was very insecure about it for a while. I was like, I always felt like insecure about, you know, why do these people, it was just weird. It didn't make sense to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's going to have a lot of impact on your sort of your view of yourself, and because other people are now viewing you so differently. Like, I could see a situation where, like, your ego gets huge because people are fawning over you. But I can also see a situation where, like, you get very insecure because you're like, I don't, like, why are people doing this? This is making me feel weird. So that was your reaction?
Yeah, I wasn't enjoying it. I was very how can I put it? I just felt like everyone had like underlying, like there was like, I don't know, it was like they had like underlying reasons, like there was like some subversive approach to it. It was unsettling to me because it didn't feel natural. It just, you know, it's not something that I'd wanted, but at the same point in time, it was such an abrupt change that there was no room for like adjustment or getting used to it or acclimated to it and appreciating it or wanting it. Obviously, you know, it's nice if somebody comes up and asks for a picture, and I was always accommodating because, you know, why wouldn't I be? You know, if somebody wants to take a picture of me, absolutely. If you want my signature, sure, why not? Thank you. You know, thank you for asking. But at the same point in time, it was still like, why is it like, why? it was very bizarre. I mean, not a lot of people get to experience it, but if you do, it's, especially the way that I did, it was just, unsettling. It took a while to kind of get a level of comfort with it, but I was always accommodating with just the way I felt about it internally and like the anxiety that it gave me. But you know, I always wanted to, anyone that asked me for like an autograph or something, like it was for me, it was an honor just to be asked. Like, it was like, wow, absolutely. Sure. Like, I don't know why you want this, but yeah.
Yeah,
so absolutely. How that. So anyone is as accommodating as possible.
Yeah, yeah. Did you ever find yourself like chasing that? I know that a lot of people come off of the show and they try to like continue on in you know, they go on other shows, or they'll, you know, they'll do whatever they can to sort of like remain to continue along with the momentum that they have. Was that ever you know, in your mind?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, ultimately the timing of 9/11 with regards to our show, there really was none of that, or I guess what you see now, or in other shows and what have you, like in Big Brother in, you know, England, the UK, it's huge. If you go on Big Brother, and no matter what happens to you after that, like, you know, you've got somebody interested in doing something with you. For me, and for us, what happened with 9/11 kind of, you know, it overshadowed, and as it should have, you know, this was our way of living under attack, and so everything else was unimportant. Everything else didn't really seem to matter as much. So with regards to the my aspirations afterwards, you know, obviously anyone that, you know, that has that opportunity, they're going to, you know, if they're interested in entertainment or anything relative to it, you know, they're going to want to utilize that momentum as much as possible. But the momentum that happened after 9/11, just completely dissipated everything with regards to that. So it really wasn't a major focus. It was just more of a, let me get back to my way of living in Miami and seeing what opportunities I can bring for myself there. You know, I'd stayed and done a few auditions in Los Angeles, and I was flying back and forth for a period of time, almost basically every week. But you know, I wasn't hanging my hat on the fact that I was on Big Brother and something's going to happen from that. I had, you know, I was working, and then flying back to do auditions and then flying back to work. And, you know, and so that was my middle upper end. I've been that period of time.
Yeah. So did that just like continue for a while? When did the next change come?
Right when I got back, when I left, I was with the Open Group. When I came back, I had, you know, all these offers from different nightclubs to, you know, be their VIP directors and be their front of house people, meet their face person. And because the Open Group had always been good to me and they were kind of like family to me at that point, I gave them the first right of refusal from any opportunities with regards to managing or, you know, or stepping further into operations. And they said, you know, give us a week. They called me the next day and they said, you know, we've got an opportunity for you. We want you to be the VIP director for our new venue that we're opening in downtown called the Living Room Downtown, which is in Miami. And so I took the opportunity and then we opened Privé. I was the VIP director there. And then from there, I had left them to go open Skybar as the general manager. That was like the next step from VIP director to being a general manager of Skybar, which is in Los Angeles. Back at the time was one of the top hotspots. And I actually had gone to Skybar in Los Angeles on a few trips when I'd stayed at the Mondrian Hotel there. So just the name recognition alone and the cachet that the name had, and the fact that we were literally like 10 times the size that they were going to be, and just that huge operation was a great challenge for me. So that's what I moved into next, and eventually went back to the Open Group as their ambassador and oversaw the operations of 8 of the nightclubs in, all throughout the country. It was a stepping stone.
Yeah, for sure. And then you met your wife.
I met my wife Liz at the Faena Hotel in Miami Beach, where I was the director of the living room. And she was just a guest the evening. And I'd walked by and I noticed her. And she, I just, you know, asked her if I could, you know, refresh her cocktail for her, because her drink was empty. And she had said yes. So I got her a cocktail and she thanked me. But she didn't show a whole lot of interest in me, which kind of like, you know, and not that it really bothered me a whole lot, but I was just, you know, I made an overt attempt to kind of make an indelible impression that didn't really come off the way that I thought I was going to go.
Yeah.
So, I walked by her again. I think I'd spoken to somebody at her table, and her friend at the table, kind of introduced us. She said, "Do you think my friend's attractive?" I'm like, "Yeah, I actually think she's beautiful." And her friend said, "Well, I think you should give her your phone number." And so I gave my business card with my cell number on it and asked her to give me a call. And I didn't hear from her for a couple of weeks. And she gave me a call and she was back in town from Chicago and we hung up and continued from there. And next thing you know, we're married with a 9-month old and then we're back living in Chicago.
Yeah. Are you excited, as a new father?
I have to tell you, it is the most amazing experience ever. It's hard to put into words because every day it changes. Just my daughter's personality. She's, you know, 9.5 months now. She's got 4 teeth, 2 at the bottom, 2 uppers in the front. And, you know, just when you think as a father, as a parent, you kind of have a handle on you know, everything, it changes. And it changes pretty quickly. So just when you get comfortable, you have to kind of readjust. And it's really a beautiful thing. And my daughter is like literally the apple of my eye. And I just thoroughly enjoy every second I get to spend with her. She's actually taking a nap right now. But when she wakes up, we're going to go to the park.
Very nice. Did you ever consider at any point that you might want to go back on Big Brother?
Well, I actually was asked for All Stars, but I had just taken the ambassadorship position with the Open Group. which was a really, it's pretty a big deal. It's a direct extension of the owners. I'm representing their interests socially throughout all their operations. So that wasn't something that I was open to at the time, but I did film, I think, a guest spot or something. I guess we did a rodeo thing one season. And I'd done the rodeo thing during our season, so they invited me back to do it again. I shot that. They'd asked me to come back to be a member of the audience for the premiere episode a couple of weeks ago. But the timing, like, I guess they made the decision last minute to ask me to do it. And we couldn't, like, I'd have to be on a plane the next morning. And the logistics of, you know, my wife and I and our daughter, I just couldn't get done. So I missed out. And not to be in the show, but to be, I guess, a featured guest in the audience. I'm not sure if they had other guests in the audience that they spoke to or what have you. But they're also going to be filming some stuff for online and for online content. But no, unfortunately, that didn't happen either. But I would have, you know, if the logistics could have worked out. It was just like, you have to be in a plane tomorrow morning. Like, yeah. Damn. Like, yeah, I can't really do that. I'm sorry. Like, I'm a responsible adult with a child now. So, yeah, this can't be like jumping on planes anymore.
Yeah. Would you, if they ask you to play again, do you think you ever would?
I don't think so. I don't know. It'd be an honor to be asked, but I think the game is the dynamic of the game has changed significantly from when I played. And you know, I really wasn't that much of a player, to be honest. I was more of a, in my mind anyway, I never had a game plan going into it. I was just kind of like, this is so new. Let's just see what this is about and what happens. Mm-hmm. And it was really, to me, just more of a sociological experiment. Meet people, you gravitate towards those you like and you have in common, you push away from those that you don't have in common, you become friends, and you become, you know, not necessarily enemies, but, like, you know, when it comes down to it, you have to make a choice. You know, people that you don't necessarily agree with everything on, you disagree with them, and that's your objective. People that you agree with, you side with them, and, you know, you try to get the other people out. And that's basically what it comes down to. Now it's so much more innuendo, and it's really, again, you know, really, really multi-layered chess when it comes down to it, because you got the veto, you've got, you know, all these different competitions, and I think it's much more involved. I think it's more interesting, I guess, for the people that are, for the audience, the people that are watching. I imagine it garners a hell of a lot more of anxiety for people that are actually playing it, because you never really know. I think you could take people at face value more so when I was playing versus now. I mean, mm-hmm. I think now there's more opportunities to stab people in the back and to really backdoor people, obviously.
Yeah, for sure. I think that was, and especially on your season, there was a lot of talk about, like, you know, not even wanting to play, you know, these deceitful kind of games, and not even wanting to win the game necessarily, but just wanting to,
I saw what people were doing, and, you know, like Shannon, I don't think Shannon would have acted the way she acted in a normal environment. I think that, you know, being in a locked, closed off set and dealing with the personality, the way to deal with it, it makes you act in a different manner for some people. For me, you know, I felt that I was remaining true to myself, that I could see how other people, to fit in or, you know, to feel more comfortable, would you know, compromise their normal integrity, you know, to say and do things that may not necessarily represent them on the outside. But at the same point in time, you know, I think it's more of your core, and, you know, your intricate values that you exhibit during those moments, instead of, you know, assuming some role. But that's just the way I think.
Yeah. So what's the plan for the future? Just focus on being a father for a while?
Yeah, we're in Chicago. Loving the weather here is amazing. It's one of the most amazing cities in the world that I've seen. And I've always wanted to live in a larger city. New York was always an aspiration of mine, but it was always, I don't know, it's just too much of a hustle and bustle, and you don't get a lot for what you pay for as far as, you know, living in an apartment or real estate there. But Chicago is really an extraordinary city in the summertime, which is what we're enjoying now. I moved in December. When I got on the plane in Miami to fly to Chicago, it was 75 degrees in Miami. And when we landed in O'Hare Airport here in Chicago, it was -5 with the wind chill. So we had a -5 degree plane. So I endured the winter to enjoy the summer. And we are enjoying the summer. It's very beautiful here. But as far as the future is concerned, I'm looking forward to additional opportunities, looking to get into some real estate opportunities in the future, and you know, expand my family. Maybe have at least one more child. I just love being a father. I got to be honest with you. It's so weird.
Yeah.
You know, when I'm out and about, I'm with my wife, and I see other kids. And other, you know, other babies, and just like I'm just drawn to that, and I'm looking at them like, oh, that's a cool stroller, huh? That's the same show we had the other baby, the stroller. Look at that, they have it set up like they're just like really, like really, like parents stuff you never thought you'd utter in a million years back
yeah.
in the day. But like, you know, it's just, you know, circumstances change, personalities don't change, but people's lives change, and your appreciation for things. Definitely adjust and adapt. I can say that firsthand.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I'm so glad to hear everything is looking good for you. Things are going well.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you. I really appreciate it, Taryn. And again, I thank you for allowing me to be a guest on your show, for inviting me. I hope I feel we had a great exchange. I hope you and your listeners have enjoyed it as well.
Yeah, for sure. I know there are going to be a lot of people that are going to be very excited to hear from you, hear what you've been up to, hear your thoughts on some of that stuff that happened way back when. And thank you. Thank you for coming on.
Listen, Taryn, thank you. And thank you to your listeners. Thank you for listening and for watching Big Brother and for being supportive for many, many seasons. I'll talk to you soon again, my friend. Have a great afternoon.
Yeah, you too.
All right, Taryn. Bye-bye.
See you later. There you go. That was Hardy from season 2 of Big Brother. Man, I think I was 9 years old, when I watched Hardy and Dr. Will and Nicole and Crying Bunky. That's how I remembered him, the crying guy, on my television. And who would have guessed that? 17 years later, I'm going to be talking to Hardy on my podcast. Crazy moment for me. I hope that you guys enjoyed that. It was very interesting to hear this, like what he thought of Big Brother back then. Definitely, of course, some interesting talk about, I think it's so forgotten just how massive of an impact 9/11 had on Big Brother. And, you know, like we could have lost the show then. It could have just been over before it even started. And it just in general, just like the impact it had on that season and the show as a whole. And just good to hear from Hardy. He's doing so well. Got a baby, got a wife. Glad everything's working out for him. And, happy about this conversation. All right. Thank you guys for tuning in to the Taryn Show this week. I hope you are enjoying the blasts from the past, and hearing from these old school players. I will absolutely try to talk to some more of them along the way, as long as I can get a hold of them. So thank you once again for joining me. I will see you next time.
Taryn's asking questions. Taryn's finding out. Taryn's looking deeper. That's what it's all about. It's the Taryn Show. So you and me can know. It's the Taryn Show.
Yeah.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.